By this point, after following Brad and Christy last week, I didn't want to do this today. I said to Christy, I was sitting there thinking, well, what could I do? I could do this thing, and I could have I could say these dire statements as treasurer, and Christy could have some musical instruments and go da 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 da, and then it was depressing even me. So I decided not to do that. So I'm just going to speak to you in an unadorned manner as treasurer of our beloved church. First of all, an idea that I came up with a few weeks ago, or that struck me a few weeks ago, is that we're a community. We know we're a community. And that is a community. We're also a household. And everyone in the household belongs to each other. They share each other's joys and sorrows and concerns and needs. And they all take care of each other in whatever manner they're able to do that, whatever manners they're able to do that. So that's something that I think it's important for us to think about. All of us take care of each other. And one way that we have to take care of each other is to provide enough financial support for our church to do what it is that we want it to do. We're a fully self-funded congregational church, which means that we decide what we want our church to be, and then we have to go about figuring out how we can do that, and then we have to take action to make the things happen that we want to see happen. In the letter that you all got with the brochure, there were a few special things mentioned. We want to support our music ministries with additional hours for our beloved director and also hopefully a paid accompanist position. We want to enhance our coffee hour, social hour activities. We want to support our first ever intern minister through some educational opportunities. Those are all wonderful things. One, because I work in the office, that's particularly on my mind all the time, is we want to support our staff. Our staff is so hardworking, so knowledgeable, so beloved, and we want to give them some kind of a cost of living increase because we need to show them our support. We need to understand how much they give of their time, their effort, their energy, their spirit to us. Last year, we were not able to give a cost of living increase, and for me personally, this is a goal that this year we don't let that happen for a second year in a row. I don't think we can let that happen for a second year in a row. Okay, we need to do what we want to do. We need approximately a $30,000 increase in pledges over last year. That seems like a lot, but in terms of increasing numbers of people in the congregation and so on, it's something that we can manage to do. How do we do this? One thing that's been mentioned in the past that I would remind you of is that if each member pledged an additional $150 over last year's pledge, we would be able to meet that commitment. This, of course, is very idealistic because not all our members are in a position to be able to do that. So one suggestion that I thought of is maybe you have a beloved friend in this community who you know is not able to increase their pledge by $150. You do it for your pledge. Maybe you do it on behalf of your friend. It can be anonymous, but maybe you say, I know Joe, he's having a hard time this year. Joe would really love to give $150 more, but he can't. I'm going to do it for him. So it's just another way of thinking about it. So far, I wanted to give you an update. So far, we have 1 week only of the campaign remaining. We have two Sundays, today and next Sunday. So far, we've received a total in pledges of almost $132,000. And that's a wonderful thing. That's something to be grateful for. However, we're still short by $127,000. So we're just slightly over halfway there with only two Sundays remaining. Think about that. Think about, even though you may have turned in your pledge card, if there's any way that you can increase that in any way to do so, but be sure and get your pledges in. Of our 146 pledging units from last year, 73 have pledged so far this year, so we have exactly half of our pledge units have repeated their pledge for this fiscal year. So we still have half of our units out there, and then in addition, just a reminder that those of you who have not pledged in the past, who might be willing to think about doing that, that's how we begin working on our budget. That's income we can count on. If you pledge and something disastrous happens in your life, you lose a job, there's an illness or whatever, and you can't make your pledge, the only person that we send after you would probably be Brad Bolton. And he's pretty short, and I think even I could take Brad Bolton. All you do is grab him by the beard and tug a little bit, and he'll leave you alone. I guarantee you. So, do your best. Promise what you can. There's a lot of work left to do. Remember that all of us in this household are working together to keep our household safe and strong and healthy and productive, and to make it what we want it to be. We need to step forward and do it. So let's all join together in raising the bar.
We light our chalice this morning in gratitude for spring rains, warm temperatures, and flowers blooming.
I grew up the youngest of three children in a two-parent household. My parents were both teachers, and we lived in a ranch home they built in 1955 on a quiet street in a small Massachusetts city. Our mortgage was $125 per month. There were two domestic-made cars in our driveway. We had food on the table, clothes to wear, bills were up to date. We took a one-week vacation every August, and each child had a small college fund. That was my normal, and I thought that's how everyone lived. I didn't know then that my middle-class childhood would be considered a luxury to many other children. I certainly know that now, and there is a certain degree of guilt and shame that accompanies the realization of the ever-widening gap between the haves and the have-nots. I am aware I have lived a life of economic and social privilege. I also know I have enough. Actually, more than enough. The awareness of that fact fuels an intrinsic need and a passion to feed the hungry and help those without permanent housing. How are you called to share your enough? Come, let us worship together.
Our story this morning is about Mary Eliza Mahoney, who was America's first black professional nurse. But first, I'll tell you a bit about my family. My family of origin didn't have a lot of money. My dad was the youngest of many children raised in a small town in southeastern Ohio. And my mom was the child of first-generation European immigrants living in Cleveland and struggling through the Depression and beyond. But as young parents, they worked hard to realize the American dream. It was always assumed that my brother and I would go to college, a state school, of course, since private schools would have been out of reach, but they worked hard to get us there, and my brother and I worked all through high school and all through college to contribute to that shared family goal. And I studied nursing. I assumed that my educational and professional path would be pretty trouble-free, and it was. I went to school, I passed my boards, I got a job as a registered nurse. It was pretty straightforward because I had bootstraps. I had the systems and the processes that supported a young, white, middle-class woman like me. I had to work for my dreams, and at times it was challenging, but my dreams always seemed attainable. There was no doubt about that. Mary Eliza Mahoney's journey to become a professional nurse was very different from my journey. Mahoney was born around 1845 in Boston. Her parents were freed slaves who had moved from North Carolina to Boston to escape the racially discriminating culture of the South. Mary Eliza Mahoney had an innate compassion and a desire to care for people, which led her to work at a hospital. She was employed by the New England Hospital for Women and Children for 15 years as a cook, as a janitor, as a laundress, and even as an unofficial nurse's aide. When she was 33 years old, she took a risk and applied to be a student at that hospital's training school for nurses. 42 women enrolled with her, but only four were able to complete the rigorous one-year course that included 16-hour days on the wards, followed by several hours of lectures and classes. Mary Eliza Mahoney was among those four, and in 1879, she received certification, becoming the first African-American registered nurse in the United States. She embarked upon a 40-year distinguished career in nursing. Her reputation was impeccable and widespread. She was sought after by many who wanted to employ such a passionate and skilled professional nurse. Not only did she raise the standards of care in the field of nursing by supporting the accomplishments of all nurses, but worked to eliminate racial discrimination in the nursing profession. After her retirement, she advocated for women's equality and voting rights for women. And in fact, Mahoney was among the first women to register to vote in Boston. She died in 1926 at the age of 80. She has been posthumously included in the American Nurses Association Hall of Fame, as well as the National Women's Hall of Fame. And awards in her name are still being bestowed to exceptional professional nurses. Mary Eliza Mahoney was a black woman, the daughter of slaves, and the first of her race to seek certification in professional nursing. She certainly did not have the systems and cultural norms to support her and serve as her bootstraps, yet she accomplished so much and touched the lives of so many in profound and lasting ways.
Would you now join me in the spirit of prayer or meditation, as is your practice? This is from William Sinkford from Voices from the Margins. Spirit of life and love, dear God of all nations, there is so much work to do. We have only begun to imagine justice and mercy. Help us hold fast to our vision of what can be. May we see the hope in history and find the courage and the voice to work for that constant rebirth of freedom and justice. That is our dream. Amen, and blessed be. A few months ago, during a conversation with a friend over lunch, somehow the phrase, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, came up. My friend commented about how this phrase is often used as a way to stop further conversation, that it prevents the full exploration of how and why overcoming one's current situation can or cannot happen. By saying that someone should just pull themselves up by their bootstraps implies that they have boots to start with. This got me thinking about how many times I've heard that expression used about me in my life. I had never been very comfortable with the phrase, but I couldn't really put my finger on why until that day with my friend. Now I understand my discomfort. The reason I was able to overcome my upbringing was because I had boots to pull up in the first place. I didn't ask for these boots, nor did I earn them. They were simply there. I grew up very poor, poorer than most people can conceive of. My parents were very young when I was born. My father was 18 and my mother was 17, and neither was able to get an education beyond high school. My father was an alcoholic who had trouble holding a job for more than a few months at a time, and my mother worked most of her life as a waitress. As a consequence, we rarely had enough to make ends meet. We quite often had our utilities turned off, and we were constantly getting evicted from the apartments we lived in. In fact, from kindergarten to seventh grade, I attended 9 different schools because we moved so much. I was always the new kid and never had many friends because I knew I'd end up leaving eventually. To make matters worse, aside from rarely having new clothes and shoes, I got a free lunch, so everyone knew I was poor. All the more reason to keep to myself. I did not participate in any school activities, play an instrument, or even go to others' birthday parties. There just wasn't money for those things. I never had birthday parties either, both because there was no money for them and because we never knew how my father would be on any given day. He was vicious and violent when drunk. So my mother and I had this tacit agreement that having people over was probably not a good idea. As hard as it is to think of today, when most of us have phones in our pockets, we quite often did not have a working telephone when I was young. When I was in the fourth grade, we lived in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and had to walk several blocks to the Circle K to make a phone call. Since almost everyone we knew lived in Ohio, most often it was a collect call, or we'd carry a couple of dimes to insert into the phone every few minutes. Our Ohio relatives had our neighbor's phone number to reach us in case of an emergency, but otherwise, there was no way to call us. We rarely had more than one working vehicle and often had to rely on others for transportation or on public transportation. The few decent cars we did have were quickly repossessed by the bank for non-payment. I learned very quickly, very early in life, that nothing good lasted, that very little in life was stable, and that life just wasn't fair. From the outside looking in to other people's lives, I was convinced that everyone had it better than I did. Of course, I know now that that was only the way it seemed, but it sure felt real at the time. When I was in middle school, we moved into a small, crooked house in Oakwood Village that had been built by my great-grandfather. My grandparents owned the home, and we lived there for over 4 years. It was the longest I had ever lived anywhere in my entire life. I know the only reason we were able to live there so long was because, despite my parents rarely being able to make rent, my grandparents refused to evict us, mainly because of my brother and I. Ironically, it was during this period of housing stability in my life that it was the darkest it's ever been. My father's alcoholism turned into serious drug addiction, and his violence increased as well. He rarely worked during this period because he really didn't have to. He didn't have rent to pay. My mother continued to work as a waitress at the Marriott Hotel in Beechwood, but she did not earn enough to keep up with everything. It seemed our utilities were turned off more than they were on, and food was scarce. I spent a lot of time with my grandparents where it was safe and warm, and there was always something to eat. I tried many times to explain to my grandparents what was going on in my home, but for reasons of their own, they wouldn't or couldn't hear me. My grandfather was a first-generation American whose parents came from the old world. My great-grandparents left their homeland of Croatia and arrived at Ellis Island in 1927. They came to America to find and live out the American dream. They did not entirely succeed. They eked out a meager living, but were eventually able to purchase a small parcel of land in Oakwood and built the little crooked house there. Because they had 4 children, and because the Depression was now upon them, my grandfather was forced to quit school at the 10th grade in order to work full-time for extra money for the family. His first job was hauling large blocks of ice packed in sawdust from house to house for people to put in their new ice boxes, some of the first home refrigerators. As a young man, he learned a trade, operating heavy machinery. He did this work for the rest of his life. He made decent money, but the work was seasonal, and he would often be laid off during the winter months. Those were hard months for my grandparents. My grandmother never worked outside the home, so they lived on unemployment benefits. They made do with what they had. And even though they certainly did not have much, they always managed to have enough. So when I tried to explain to them the situation that my parents were in, they were just not equipped to understand how addiction affects families or why my father, their son, didn't work. My mother's parents, while on paper were the polar opposite of my father's parents, shared the viewpoint of the American dream with my other grandparents. These grandparents were white-collar, upper-middle-class, educated people. My grandfather was an inventor, an electrician, and a machinist who wore a suit and tie to work every day. He earned a very good living, and they were able to raise their 4 children in relative comfort and safety. Both of my grandparents on my mom's side came from families who had settled in America many generations before. In fact, my grandmother could trace her family all the way back to the Revolutionary War. Their parents had been successful, they had been successful, and they fully expected each of their offspring to be successful as well. So you can imagine their shock and dismay when my mother became pregnant with me when she was only 17. The two sides of my family were vastly different from each other in socioeconomic standing and background, but the one thing they had in common was their belief in the American dream. They were all fully invested in the idea that with enough hard work and perseverance, everyone could achieve their goals. And I was too. I didn't have the vaguest notion of what I wanted to do with my life then, but I was sure that once I decided, I would be able to achieve it. And for the most part, this was and is true for me. What I didn't know then, that it wasn't and isn't true for everyone, that there are many hidden social factors that determine who can and cannot succeed, that the American dream is just that, a dream. The term American dream was first made popular by historian James Truslow Adams in his 1931 book, The Epic of America. Adams defined the phrase as that dream of a land in which we should be better and richer, and where life should be better, richer, and fuller for every man, with opportunity for each according to his ability or achievement. The American dream fulfills the promise of a meritocracy, the idea that our society will reward those who work hard and never give up. The American meritocratic ideal is historically and fundamentally rooted in the fact that we are a society of immigrants. Those first waves of Europeans who landed here came with the knowledge that the hereditary aristocracies of Europe would be replaced with the American ideal of freedom to achieve based on personal merit. As Thomas Jefferson put it, America would replace the European aristocracy of birth with the new American natural aristocracy of talent and virtue. This is the ideal my forefathers and foremothers certainly bought into, and unless you are of pure Native American bloodlines, chances are good that yours did too. In fact, the majority of Americans still believe this today. In several different surveys that I read, the results were clear. Over two-thirds of Americans believe that people are rewarded for intelligence and skill, while less than one-fifth believe that coming from a wealthy family ensures success. As of 2011, 91% of people believe that hard work is one of, if not the most, important factors in determining success in America. Interestingly, and not at all surprisingly, those people surveyed who were amongst the poorest and most marginalized agreed with the previous statements, but also added that they were much more likely to not be able to achieve the American dream because of discrimination and family background. So all of this circles back to the proverbial boots that I pulled myself up by. Have you ever had one of those aha or light bulb moments? Well, I did. I vividly remember having one when I was just 14 years old, when life in the little crooked house was practically unbearable. I vowed to myself that I would never live this way, that I would do better, I would be better than anyone in my family. And even though it was a long, winding, bumpy, difficult, circular road, I got there eventually. What I know now is that I was able to achieve all that I did because, by luck and circumstance, my immigrant ancestors were the right kind of people, white, Christian Europeans. I was able to go to college and graduate school because that door was always open for me. The only choice I had to make was if and when I would walk through. By taking advantage of this opportunity, I was reaping the benefits of the privileges whites have in America, and I had no idea I was doing so. I'm very sure that most of you, at the very least, have heard of white privilege, and I'm also very sure that many of you have studied it in depth. No matter where you fall on the spectrum of your knowledge about white privilege, every white person has experienced its advantages at some point, most of us on a daily basis. Now, I will say that when you are poor, like I was most of my life, having someone tell you that you are privileged is absurd and even offensive. But no matter how we feel about it, the fact remains, it is an inescapable part of our culture. In fact, there are many different kinds of privilege: white privilege, middle class privilege, male privilege, Christian privilege, straight privilege, ability privilege. The list goes on and on. The common factor in all of these is one simple thing. The more you conform to the norms and dominant groups of society, the more privilege you have. So while you may not reap the benefits of, say, Christian privilege, perhaps you get benefits from white or straight privilege. Paul Kiev, in his book from our library, Uprooting Racism, puts it this way: benefits from racism are amplified or diminished by our relative privilege. People with disabilities, people with less formal education, and people who are lesbian, gay, or bisexual are generally discriminated against in major ways. All of us benefit in some ways from whiteness, but some of us have cornered the market on significant benefits from being white to the exclusion of others. In her widely acclaimed article, White Privilege: Unpacking the Invisible Backpack, Peggy McIntosh explains privilege this way: I have come to see white privilege as an invisible package of unearned assets which I can count on cashing in each day, but about which I was meant to remain oblivious. White privilege is like an invisible, weightless backpack of special provisions, maps, passports, code books, visas, clothes, tools, and blank checks. She lists 26 privileges of being white that affect most people on a daily basis. If you'd like to read the whole list, I would encourage you to find her article online. If you Google white privilege, invisible backpack, it will come right up. I would like to lift up just a few of this list this morning. So as I read this list, I would like you to try to keep a mental tally of which ones affect you daily or weekly. Number one, if I wish to, I can arrange to be in the company of people of my race most of the time. Number two, I can go shopping alone most of the time, pretty well assured that I will not be followed or harassed. I can turn on the television or open the front page of the paper and see people of my race widely represented. When I am told about our national heritage or about civilization, I am shown that people of my color made it what it is. I can be sure that my children will be given curricular materials that testify to the existence of their race. I can go into a music shop and count on finding the music of my race, into a supermarket and find the food staples which fit my cultural traditions, or into a hairdresser's shop and find someone who can cut my hair. Whether I have checks, credit cards, or cash, I can count on my skin color not to work against the appearance of financial reliability. I am never asked to speak for all the people of my racial group. I can criticize our government and talk about how much I fear its policies and behavior without being seen as a cultural outsider. I can easily buy posters, postcards, picture books, greeting cards, dolls, toys, and children's magazines featuring people of my race. I can choose blemish cover or Band-Aids in flesh color and have them more or less match my skin. So I'm going to go out on a limb here and assume that everyone mentally checked off at least one. Yeah? Okay. If not several, right, of all of these. I know I can. So McIntosh goes on to say that privilege has turned out to be an elusive and fugitive suspect. The pressure to avoid thinking and talking about it is great, for in facing it, we must give up the myth of meritocracy. If these things are true, this is not such a free country. One's life is not what one makes it. Many doors open for certain people through no virtues of their own. But one factor seems clear about all of the interlocking oppressions of privilege. Each takes both active forms, which we can see, and embedded forms, which as a member of the dominant group, one is taught not to see. In my class and place, I did not see myself as a racist because I was taught to recognize racism only in individual acts of meanness by members of my group, never in the invisible systems conferring unsought racial dominance on my group from birth. So what does this mean for us? Should we feel guilty? Should we beat ourselves up about the fact that we've taken advantage, however unwittingly, of these privileges? I would say no, surely not. There is no way each of us individually could be held responsible for the privileges our society bestows upon us by virtue of characteristics we have no control over. But that need not be the end of the story. Now that we know, now that we are aware, we can work for change. We can draw attention to and work against those kinds of privileges that are so deeply ingrained in our culture as to be practically invisible. It isn't easy work, but nothing affecting social change ever is. Our second principle calls us to affirm and promote justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. May our work in changing the culture of privilege take us one step further toward this goal. May it be so, and amen. Martin Luther King Jr. tells us that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. Let us take our hope for justice out into a weary and broken world. Go in peace.